You're very welcome back to the programme. With me in studio tonight are the chief executive of the children's charity Barnardo's and former Labour Party adviser Fergus Finlay. Also here, Stephen O'Byrnes, owner and director of MKC Communications, one of the biggest PR and political lobbying groups in the country. Regina Doherty is a Fine Gael TD and a member of the committee scrutinising the upcoming legislation which aims to make lobbying more transparent. And John Devitt, chief executive of Transparency International Ireland. We're discussing government lobbying on the programme tonight, how it works, if and how it needs to change, and when it crosses the line into corruption. It's in the news at the moment because of Frank Flannery, Director of Elections for Fine Gael in the 80s, 90s and noughties. He's been described as their chief strategist. He's been a board member of Rehab since 2006 after leaving the post of chief executive of that group. And he's worked for a long time as a PR consultant, in other words, a lobbyist. 3 years ago, Rehab paid him to lobby various government departments. And then it emerged today that he was also paid by another charity called Philanthropy Ireland to lobby the Department of Finance for tax changes. At the time, he was chairman of the Forum for Philanthropy, a government-appointed post. Over the past few days, he has resigned from all of these posts. Stephen O'Byrnes, it's so convoluted that you'd have to wonder at some point, was Frank Flannery lobbying himself?
It's a good point. I have to say, I've known Frank not terribly well, but I've known him for about 30 years, I'd say. And I would genuinely regard him as the most brilliant electoral strategist of any party in Ireland over that period. I mean, the man has been, he's just amazing. I'm sure Regina would vouch for that in terms of his capacity to identify where to place candidates and to identify, you know, the lineage of candidates and where parties' parcels of votes had lain historically and all that. I mean, the man is a genius at that. I'm personally very surprised, as somebody who would have trodden some of the same routing as himself, that he's found himself in such a bind and that he got into such a mess, because he reached a stage where he was seriously conflicted as between, you know, making representations as a lobbyist. And, you know, I mean, particularly in the philanthropy one, you know, Frank is so powerful that he was, you know, a kind of a quasi Fine Gael minister, in effect. You know, I mean, he helped to get some of the most senior members of the present government elected, you know, in their earlier days and so forth. So I'm astonished that he did not see that he was crossing a very clear, you know, not even a delicate line, but a clear enough line as between, you know, lobbying government and being too close to that, you know, being almost, as I say, a quasi-member of that government. So, I mean, I think it's very regrettable what has happened. I think belatedly he has probably done the right thing in terms of quitting the scene. And I really, you know, I'm sorry for him for what has happened. I've always found him to be a very decent person. I've had very little dealings with him, other than we'd know each other sort of professionally and somewhat personally over about 30 years.
Regina Doherty, what's your view on all of this? To the outside person, it all seems very, very cosy.
Well, first of all, can I say my personal opinion is that Frank is a thoroughly decent man. He is obviously highly regarded within Fine Gael and, as Stephen has said, been hugely influential with regard to strategy, leading obviously to electoral success. But more importantly, for me as a person, he's hugely highly regarded in the disability sector and, you know, notwithstanding what we're currently talking about, has given 35 years service to the disability service or sector, and that cannot be discounted. If we're to talk about lobbying, and it's in the programme for government, which was set out 3 years ago, this government wants to make sure that it is open and transparent and that we know exactly who's lobbying, on behalf of whom, for what, and how much they're getting paid for. And that was the drafts heads of the bill that were put to the Finance Committee a number of months ago. The report was sent back to the Minister and those draft legislation is now ready to be published.
But didn't you get it very badly wrong then as a government? If on the one hand in your manifesto, your programme for government rather, there was this aim and setting out how you're going to do it. And then on the other hand, Phil Hogan was appointing Frank Flannery as chairman of this Forum for Philanthropy.
Yeah, but it's an unpaid position that Frank was doing on behalf of the government, which was a thoroughly good thing to do.
But he was being paid by another charity to lobby the government as chairman of the Forum for Philanthropy.
OK, well, I'll say two things. Number one, you make the assumption that Phil knew at the time of his appointment and I don't know whether he did or not. And with the height of respect to Frank, and I hope this isn't insulting, his lobbying didn't work. I mean, the two sets of lobbying that's currently in the domain that we know about is one on behalf of rehab to the Minister for Justice. And we all know how highly critical the Minister for Justice is around rehab's lottery scheme, as was outlined in the Dáil by the Minister a number of weeks ago. And the second piece of information that we know is that he lobbied the Minister for Finance with regard to tax exemptions and residency status for people who would be pertaining to give charitable donations, and that didn't work either. So, okay, either he's not a very good lobbyist, and I say that tongue in cheek, or the government is completely and wholly honest in its endeavours to
present. But I go back to my first point to you about the perception of this from the public, is that it's all very cosy. Was there nobody else that Phil Hogan could have appointed to that role other than Fine Gael's chief strategist?
I have to tell you, I would think that he was probably one of the most best suited people for the job, given his history and his endeavours with philanthropic organisations and with his engagements with those organisations.
How widely did Phil Hogan look?
I don't know. So I can't make it up for you.
I wouldn't disagree with what Regina has said on that point. I mean, appointing Frank Flannery to the particular post, I wouldn't have a problem with that per se, because, again, of his background in with rehab and the fact that he had retired as chief executive and so forth. No, but that's why I think in turn then that Frank, in that position, should not have taken on a paid a role for Philanthropy Ireland, I think it was, wasn't it? To in effect almost, I'm not saying lobby himself, but certainly one of the targets. If Philanthropy Ireland had come to me and said, you know, would you take on a lobbying assignment for us? One of the people I would want to lobby would have been the Forum, you know, the Frank Flannery Forum. So, you know, to take your opening remark, I mean, it had a configuration that Frank was being paid to lobby himself in part.
But Stephen, do you accept the perception, that the cosy perception that it is, that there was nobody else in the whole of the public service sector, people who have given as many years as Frank Flannery have to various causes and issues and so on, that could have done that job?
I accept that perception is can be drawn, but again, I think in fairness, you go back to the track record of Frank Flannery and the organisation rehab that he had developed and that he had led for something like 34 years, was it? Yeah, I mean, he was preeminently suited for that appointment, in my view. Yes, I'm sure there are others who would have, but I mean, I can understand. And look, at the end of the day, there is a tendency, human nature being what it is, that no matter what political party you're in, if you're looking around for somebody to do a voluntary role, in particular a voluntary role. So therefore, you know, if it was a paid role, I think the criticism is far more valid as to have an open appointments system and so forth. But if it's a voluntary role and you're looking around and there's this guy you know extremely well and he's fulfilled this role for almost 35 years at rehab, I think appointing him to head up a voluntary group, I don't have an issue. The issue arises when Frank then in turn accepted a paid retainer to lobby on behalf of Philanthropy Ireland.
And Fergus Finlay, isn't that the way things are done in this country? I mean, some people are wondering how this could have happened to Frank Flannery, but the perception is that the same people are appointed to everything in this country, and it was inevitable that this would eventually happen.
Well, it certainly was the way things were done in this country. I thought things had changed. I probably should preface, like Regina and Stephen, I should probably preface what I say about Frank Flannery by saying that, you know, he's somebody I've known for years, often in a competitive kind of way, but a friendly sort of way. Never somebody that, you know, did anything dishonourable to me or, you know, in political terms that I know of. But I'm still dumbfounded by what's happened here. I looked today at the Memorandum and Articles of Association of Rehab, the organisation of which he was chief executive for years, and therefore I would suspect had a hand in drawing them up, the organisation of which he was a board member. There is a clear statement within those memo and arts that prohibits a member of the board from taking paid employment with rehab. It's not possible. And yet we discovered that he was drawing very considerable fees for, you know, paid employment on behalf of rehab.
For lobbying,
mm-hmm. for lobbying around issues that were of interest to them. Now, if he was lobbying anybody as a member of the board or as chief executive of rehab about issues of concern to rehab or issues of concern to the wider disability movement, that's perfectly legitimate. If he's paid outside the terms of outside the memo and arts of the organisation, inappropriately paid to look after rehab's corporate interests, that's completely and absolutely beyond the pale, unacceptable. And it's a line that, you know, it's not a fine line. There's no subtle point here. It's a clear breach of his fiduciary responsibilities and his responsibilities to rehab. And to then do the same thing with Philanthropy Ireland, as chairman of Philanthropy Ireland, to go and lobby for money, for fees, the government, you know, whose viewpoint he wanted to influence legitimately, but to do it for fees, I just don't get it. I just can't understand how, in any scheme of things, that can be regarded as acceptable. So you've used the phrase several times that it's about perception. It's not. It's not about perception. This is wrong. It is taking, it's giving lobbying a bad name. It gives rehab a bad name. It gives Philanthropy Ireland a bad name. And it gives Frank Flannery a bad name. And it is just not acceptable.
John Devitt, presumably you would agree with much of that.
Yeah, I think much of what's gone on, it seems to stem from a lack of awareness of the rights and wrongs around lobbying. Gary Murphy last night was talking about the distinction between covert and overt lobbying. Lobbying in itself is not a bad thing. It can inform public policy. It's essential to bring in different viewpoints on elements of public policy and to spell out the potential consequences for different constituencies of any decision a minister or senior official might make. But there are clear lines to be drawn, as Fergus has just said. If you're on the board of a charity, you do not get paid to lobby or to do any work on behalf of that charity. Your role is as a governor, not as a staff member or a consultant. And for that line to be crossed is unacceptable. But I wouldn't just blame Frank Flannery for this. It's the board of rehab, mm-hmm. the funders of Philanthropy Ireland, who have greenlighted these payments and have answered questions to answer as well. And until we have more heightened awareness of the roles and responsibilities of board members, of lobbyists working for both non-profit and for profit organisations, we're going to see these kind of controversies emerge in the future.
It actually looks, John, as if rehab tried to hide the payments because they were all made through one of its British subsidiaries. They weren't made. The lobbying was done on behalf of corporate rehab, but the payments were made by one of its British subsidiaries that had no interest whatsoever in the outcome of the lobbying.
Well, we don't know if they were trying to hide the payments.
I don't know. I didn't say they were. I said it looked as if they were.
We don't know if they were or not. But on that point, Regina Doherty, if there is a breach, as Fergus Finlay says, of the guidelines involving charities and being paid and so on, do you agree that that is completely unacceptable?
Of course, if there is a breach. We're having a conversation here about a hypothetical that we don't know. We're in a vacuum of information. What will be interesting to see is the response, which obviously the PAC is not going to discuss till tomorrow, of rehab to the 12 questions that they were asked at the last meeting. And I hope genuinely that obviously that will give rise to answers to an awful lot of the questions that we have currently around the finances within rehab and unanswered questions.
Do you think Frank Flannery should still appear before the PAC even though he has resigned from rehab?
Yes, I do, if he has things to answer for. So I would actually suspect that maybe a lot of the answers to our questions will be given tomorrow. But if they're not, absolutely he should appear. But I actually don't think that he will have a problem appearing. But it would be nice in the first instance, first of all, if had he been asked. And he hasn't been asked. And we've talked a lot and our different people
you
respond.
Believe, I mean, you don't, because we have heard consistently over the last number of weeks from the PAC that they asked him to appear.
Yeah, we have
but
heard
because
consistently.
What, they didn't write to his home.
No. Well, how did they write to him? Because that's the issue. Hmm. They haven't as of yet. And so under normal circumstances, if a committee wants to invite somebody in to sit in front of them to ask their questions or for whatever reasons to give testimony or witness, they write to him and ask. They have not written to him. So at the very least, instead of going on to the radio, members of the PAC should decide to write to him and ask him to come in to give him an opportunity to say either yes or no, instead of being on radio all week saying that he has refused to come in. How can somebody refuse to come in front of a committee that he hasn't been asked to come in and sit? sit in front of. So, you know, from that perspective, it's very much about political point scoring, which is a pity with regard to our Public Accounts Committee, when what they're grounded in doing is making sure and ensuring that the taxpayer is getting value for money. Absolutely, we need to know what Frank's business or Frank directly was paid for with regard to public money that were paid from rehab. Absolutely, we do. And if that doesn't become aware, transparent tomorrow, well, then an invitation should be extended to him and the opportunity for him to sit in front of PAC to explain, you know, what work he did or didn't do should be afforded to him before we, you know, hang, draw and quarter him on radio shows.
John.
Well, it's clear that there was a conflict of interest arising from his paid employment as a consultant for rehab and for Philanthropy Ireland and his board membership of the organisations or his membership of the Forum on Philanthropy. I don't think he needs to come before the PAC for us to find out whether there was a conflict of interest or not. It's manifestly a conflict of interest.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. To what end, what would be achieved by appearing before the PAC to give answers if a lot of this, granted his pension arrangements and all of that with rehab are not in the public domain, but other stuff is
I'm
now.
I'm pretty sure that he would be asked about more than just his paid consultancy roles. He was chair of rehab. And PAC have questions about how money, public money, was spent by that charity. The government has tabled legislation which will go some way to opening up lobbying to greater public scrutiny and to prevent abuse. But it doesn't deal with this kind of case happening in the future. It will provide for tighter controls on payment of lobbyists and greater disclosure of contacts between lobbyists and public officials. But it won't cover lobbyists who are also staff members or paid advisors to political parties. Mm-hmm. And we've been calling for cooling off periods for senior public officials, ministers and members of the Oireachtas who then go into the private sector or even in the non-profit sector and are lobbying on behalf of commercial interests in those non-profit organisations. So as to allow some time to lapse before they go into the private sector, so as not to bring a competitive advantage to any one company, an unfair advantage to them by virtue of the information that they have and the contacts that they have. Frank Flannery had more access to the Taoiseach and senior government ministers than other cabinet members and junior ministers. He was indispensable to the Fine Gael party. Mm-hmm. And he could use that access. I'm not saying he abused the access or influence he had, but there's a reasonable perception of a risk arose that he could use that access to the benefit of those who were paying him to influence public policy, whether or not the outcomes were in the favour of those private interests. A perception of a conflict was arising by virtue of the access that he had and the official role he had within the Fine Gael party. And the same could apply to any lobbyists in the past, whether PJ Mara or anyone else, mm-hmm. who had been working as paid advisors to political parties and then lobbied the same people that they were working for on behalf of companies or whoever. And there need to be controls in place to put some distance between paid advisors to political parties and the lobbying industry.
Do you agree with that, Stephen?
I think there's a distinction in part that this is very complicated when you drill it down. I think when you talk about ex-ministers and ex-senior civil servants, I think there has to be some, you know, so-called gardening leave, as it would be called. What the period is I think open to debate, but I think the principle of somebody, you know, who may have been a government minister yesterday and ceasing to be a government minister today and then becoming a lobbyist tomorrow, I think that's wrong. I think it's equally if you're a former, you know, a senior civil servant, secretary general, assistant secretary general, and so on. All I can do is recall my own situation. I worked for 4.5 years in government in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, once the government that I was a member of fell, you know, I left my period as a temporary civil servant ceased. I got no, you know, my payment ceased. So
you were with the Progressive Democrats.
That's right, yeah. And you know, there was no pension, there was nothing attendant upon it. So you know, you didn't, if you've served out 7 years as Secretary General, obviously you get very generous, retirement package, ditto with ministers and so forth. So I mean, I'm talking about John mentioned special advisers, for instance. And indeed, there are a whole crop of special advisers to the various ministers. And there's no doubt, looking at it from where I would look at it, they have an understanding of how the system works. They have a keen political knowledge, all very valuable attributes, you know, once you step into the private sector. But whether what kind of an arrangement should apply to people like that, one argument, I guess, that would apply is, well, if you take up the post and albeit you don't get any pension or any kind of easement payment once you leave, so be it. You might, you know, I think in principle the idea of some kind of cooling off period is appropriate even with those people, because if you go in and take the post, it has its attractions. It's a very interesting kind of career for a couple of years, might be very demanding, but it certainly is very fulfilling. And if you know that, well, look, when I step out, I won't be able to work in a similar role as a lobbyist for, say, 12 months or whatever, and you knew that, well, I think if I was starting all over again, I would take my chances, you know?
Fergus Findlay, what's your view on this? Because you were in a role back in the day as special advisor to the Labour Party, and I think it was Jim Daly on News Talk this morning was saying that people like yourself, Peter Power, Barry Andrews, were heading up charities now, and largely because it was advantageous for the charities because of your political connections.
The irony of that, I guess, is that when I was asked to take the job of CEO of Bernardo's, the only concern the board had, perhaps they had other concerns, but the only concern they shared with me was that there was a Fianna Fáil government in office at the time, and I was seen as something of an antichrist by the Fianna Fáil government, and therefore would this be detrimental to the interests of Bernardo's? And I said at the time, I just didn't know. I hadn't the faintest idea. I really wanted to do the job. I wanted to kind of give it my all. But I was very conscious of the fact that the baggage I carry, which is, you know, I can't deny, and I've never denied it, could actually hurt Bernardo's. Now, it didn't turn out that way. At least I hope it didn't. And therefore, you know, the only answer I can give to the question is, the answer that I think applies in every situation. I mean, it's the same here in RTE. You know, people have left RTE and gone to work in political roles. And they've come back to RTE after that. And there's a phrase that I understand is used in RTE that there has to be a decontamination period before they can be, you know, active in commenting on matters that have to do with politics again. And we all know the names of a number of people, distinguished people who have come and gone and come back again.
Well, George Lee was the most recent.
George Lee was the most recent, but Sean Dagenham before that and various other people. And, you know, and they've all managed to resume careers that were untainted by political involvement. Now, I've now been CEO. I was trying to think today, like, who have I lobbied in the last 9 years as CEO of Bernardo's? I recently asked the Minister for Children if she would look at an idea to do with play. She met a couple of colleagues of mine with me, kind enough to invite us to lunch, asked us to go away and develop the idea again. That's probably lobbying. I've advocated and campaigned about referenda, about budget policy, about that's probably all lobbying. It's all out in the open. Every bit of it is out in the open. The only bit of lobbying that I did that I think was kind of on behalf of Bernardo's corporate interests was I asked the Minister for Communications if he would help us to secure the publication of a stamp to record the fact that Bernardo's was operating 50 years in Ireland last year, and he very kindly agreed to help, and a stamp did appear. All of that was also kind of done. It's very hard to actually produce a stamp in private, in secret. So I suppose in a way, I have no problem, never had any problem with lobbying. I have a real problem when it's done in secret. whether it's Stephen or me or whoever it is, if you go on to a career that involves making representations to government, you must be prepared to do it in the open. Yeah. You have to be prepared to do it in
and
the
in
open.
And what do you mean now, in the open? How does that work in practice?
Well, certainly in the case of Bernardo's, all our lobbying is done in written form. Right. It's all done by way of letter and correspondence, by way of public campaign, and so on. It's all checkable. It's all published. It's always accompanied by press release. There has never been a single instance where we've gone to a meeting and you know, been unable to tell anyone about it.
Could I say, I would totally agree with what Fergus has just said. And the actual is the secrecy that actually can it be part of what is damaging to the to the profession of lobbying. It's got to the stage, and I recall at the time of the Frank Dunlop saga, when he ended up in prison, journalists would ring me up and say, well, where do you stand on the question of a register of lobbyists and so forth? But I as far back as then, I made it very clear, I very much support the idea of a register of what's termed lobbyists, though. And again, I would like to stress that our company, in common with, I think it's 27 or other 28 other PR stroke lobbying companies in Ireland, are members of the Public Relations Consultants Association. We have strongly supported the proposed bill that Brendan Howland has brought forward. There have been various seminars. We have contributed to it. We've submitted papers. And indeed, like this idea has been around with successive governments. I think it will finally come to pass. To use a cliche, the devil is in the detail, because what we are arguing for as an association, and indeed it was my colleague Laurie Mannix as chairperson who brought forward our collective proposals, we want to see lobbying rather than lobbyists being the title, a register of lobbying. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that people like myself fear is that you have professions like accountants and solicitors who also lobby, but who would deem themselves to be protected by client confidentiality and things like that, and which would end up, totally disadvantaging people like myself and people in other companies like myself. Mm-hmm. But Fergus is absolutely on the money when he talks about doing the stuff in the open, because I'd find myself even at times reluctant to even use the term lobbyist, because it has a taint of some kind of sleazy or underhand dealing. Whereas, in fact, lobbying, I mean, Regina is an elected public lobbyist. She's there to lobby on behalf of the constituents of Meath. She will go along and she will lobby ministers and is damn good at it. And our society wouldn't work effectively without lobbying. And Fergus describes his job and says, that is lobbying. I do it on behalf of clients. I get paid sometimes. Sometimes I don't. If I'm interested in a cause, I will take it up.
Okay.
But, sorry.
No, Regina, you wanted in there.
No, I wanted to just come in and say, number one, I agree totally with Fergus, because it's the secrecy element that gives lobbying a bad name. Lobbying is an extremely good activity, and it's central to our democracy. And the devil is in the detail. So let me share the detail with you. What's in the bill is that, number one, it will be a statutory lobbying web-based register. It will be monitored and maintained and regulated by SIPO, and it will have a one-year cooling-off period. And the people that it will pertain to, as in the lobbied, will be ministers, ministers of state, TDs, senators, and all members of their staff, members of local authorities, and all special advisers to the above, the Ombudsman, Comptroller, the Auditor General, civil servants, public servants, as prescribed by the ministers, and any other such persons or categories of persons that will be prescribed by the ministers. So there's no more instances of that we can lobby the special advisor and it's not really the same as lobbying the minister. The detail of any lobbying activity, what it was for, who it was on behalf of, and how much money crossed hands or changed hands, if any.
Will it specify, who can be a lobbyist? In the sense that, would it have made any difference in the Frank Flannery case, for example?
Well, let me put it this way. If the details of what Frank did was lobbying, if the register was available today or had it been available during his period, then the activity would have been lobbied. What it was for, who it was on behalf of, and how much money was paid for that lobbying activity would have been part of the strategy register and would be regulated by SIPO, yes.
John. I mean, it won't deal with someone like Frank Flannery or anyone else in a political party who's paid by the political party also lobbying. A paid member of a political party should not be
allowed to political party.
He was a central figure within Fine Gael, director of elections.
Yeah, but he wasn't. He's not a paid member of Fine Gael.
He was very close to, or he was effectively an official within the party. The point here is that there are a number of shortcomings with the legislation or the proposals as they stand. They won't, for instance, automatically afford people the right to know what information is being shared between the lobbyist and the public official. Ministerial certificates will still be available to a minister to withhold information in relation to any lobbying effort by a company or an individual lobbyist. Advisors who are invited by the government to brief them, either in groups such as the Company Law Review Group or the Financial Services Clearing House Group, will not be subject to this legislation.
That's not lobbying.
You can still be a lobbyist and still advise the government. I've been advising the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, Brendan Howland's department, on the whistleblower legislation. I had a 3-hour meeting with officials of the department a few months ago. That meeting would not, by definition, fall under the terms of this regulation. It should. I'm happy to tell you what I discussed with the officials, and all the submissions we've made be publicly available. But there are ways and means of getting around this. PJ Mara in the Irish Examiner recently called the proposals bullshit. Mm-hmm. He explained that much of lobbying is done in dark corners of pubs around Dublin, Donny and Nesbitt's, you know where they are. And it won't capture much of what's going on around the halls and the corridors of power. Mm-hmm. And it needs not just to capture the contacts between politicians and or public officials and lobbyists, but also the content of the discourse. We need to know what is being shared. And there's an onus on public officials to minute and diary meetings that they've had with lobbyists, whether it's in Donny Nesbitt's or the cafe of Leinster House.
It's not a fair point, Fergus, because, I mean, John mentioned PJ Mara there, and he says civil servants and those at the heart of government are increasingly less likely to record information about sensitive meetings. Civil servants, as I understand it, he says, are putting less and less stuff on emails. If you're talking to a senior politician, you don't write to him.
I've been hearing this argument for years and years and years. When freedom of information was first mooted, the senior civil service in Ireland pretty well declared it the end of civilization as they knew it, and everybody was suddenly going to verbalise everything, write nothing down, etc., etc. Actually, the system adapts. The system doesn't collapse in a heap when you bring legislation like this in. I think there's actually a relatively easy solution to the dilemma that John poses, which is a genuine dilemma. As I understand it, under the anti-corruption legislation that is in existence, there's an onus of proof on the person who receives a payment to establish that it wasn't corrupt. And I think you can have a similar onus of proof in relation to legislation of this kind. If somebody grabs you, let's say, in a tent on the Galway racecourse, mm-hmm. and has a few quiet words in your ear, then the minister whose ear is being bent should have a statutory obligation to establish that he wasn't being lobbied, or else report it as lobbying, mm-hmm. one or the other. It's quite simple and quite straightforward. And of course, you can't legislate for people who are happy to break the law. Mm. You're never going to be able to legislate for people who are happy to cheat the system. But in 99% of cases, if you make it an offence, then 99% of politicians and public servants will not break the law. If they know it is an offence to do it, they won't do it.
But would that work here, Stephen, when the country is so small, when that sector of society is even smaller and everyone knows everybody else? Like, you're not going to report somebody that you know.
Well, I think it's important, though, when you look at the detail, and Regine has outlined some of the detail of the legislation, but also, and John touched on it there, one of the proposals that we as the PRCA, the Public Relations Consultants Association, raised in our submission was the issue, say, of ministers recording, keeping diaries and publishing details of the meetings that they have. Because I think that's an important, that's the other side of the equation, you might say. And I think, again, that would contribute towards the transparency and the openness of the overall process. I disagree strongly with John's point that, does you know, that effectively, that lobbying is being done in the snugs of bars and so forth. To be honest, that's a kind of a stereotype that, and I don't know if Fergus would share my view.
But we've heard an awful lot, I'm not talking about lobbying being done in snug bars, but over the last few days in relation to Frank Flannery, numerous government ministers have said, oh yeah, I had an informal chat with him, informal chat with him, informal chat with him.
But I can assure you that the norm that applies now, and I have to say that the civil, you know, senior civil servants, people, you know, who are involved in formulating legislation, who in some instances are probably the more important party that you want to lobby rather than the minister in the first instance, because they are the ones bringing forward the first or the second draft of proposed legislation. And if you're lobbying on behalf of a client who is very anxious and for very good reason from a commercial point of view or whatever, to make sure that their viewpoint, their concerns are aired and ventilated at that level, I find the civil servants, by and large, are very receptive. So long as the process is an open and above board one, you're invariably emailing a request for a meeting. You might even be emailing the outlines of the issue you want to discuss. Like, I do think it's important that both for the sake of the people who are engaged in the political process, the civil service in particular, and indeed I'd like to think people like myself who earn some of their living from this kind of occupation are engaged in a process that is essentially open, above board and transparent. And it is very easy to track it all down.
The wise politician and the wise public servant, and I, you know, we all know a lot of them, have a very simple way of dealing with this. They hand the petitioner a card. Here's my card. That's fascinating. Would you ever drop me a line about it? Now, if the person is serious and they want to drop them a line, well, now you've crossed the line into safe territory. If they don't drop your line, you take no action. Full stop, end of story. The lobbying has fallen on deaf ears. And you haven't offended anybody, because the fear for an awful lot of politicians, I mean, I remember somebody saying years ago when, you know, there were certain other things going on, why would you ever bother trying to bribe a county councillor in Ireland, because they hate saying no anyway. But the wise ones... I'm only quoting what somebody else said, Regina. It wasn't something I said myself. The wise ones will say, listen, very interesting, drop me a line. And that's how you protect yourself, do you know? And that's how you protect the system as well. You then, a paper trail starts, the thing goes on the record. And if it doesn't go on the record, that's the end of the matter.
John.
I mean, I don't think we can discount the risk of abuse associated arising from political,
I wasn't suggesting.
I was coming back to Stephen's point here. I don't think we can discount the risk of abuse of personal relationships. The Moriarty Tribunal report highlighted the risks, those risks in particular. But it's important to highlight the fact that lobbyists are still walking around the corridors of Leinster House. They're sitting waiting around in the cafe area of the new wing, and they're waiting to meet with a lobbyist to spend 5 or 10 minutes, or with a public official or a public representative to have 5 or 10 minutes in their ear. And in very many cases, decisions,
I don't know who they are now, because they have the upper hand.
I disagree with John there, and I'll ask Regina if she would which version she would deem to be the correct one. In fairness, access to Leinster House at the moment, and for some time, is very restricted. If I want to go into the house and I want to meet Regina, I have to ring up Regina. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, if she has time, she'll see me once she knows what I'm on about. I won't be a nuisance. If I have something meaningful, I hope. And that is, you know, you won't, once you get in there then, you're not going to be allowed to hang around.
Flannery did not have to ask someone to go in.
No, because he had a Fine Gael pass. It's entirely different.
Exactly.
But okay, let me give you an example of something that happened to me today. A young lady travelled from Cork on the train. She had an appointment with me at 12:30. For some reason, she arrived at 11:15. She was left sitting in the main hall in Leinster House until I could be found. She wanted to go to the toilet. She wanted to go for a cup of coffee. She was left sitting. on a sofa in the main hall in Leinster House. There is not a case of people are floating around Leinster House, as you would believe. It does not happen. But it is genuinely true that we get lobbied on a daily basis, but by appointment. It doesn't happen that people are skulking in corners waiting to hop out with the clipboard.
But she wouldn't be allowed to roam around Leinster House, Regina, but more people who are known within political circles, would they not be?
Okay, but the only way you will be known in Leinster House is either to be a member of staff, which Frank was perceived to be by the pass that he had from a Fine Gael perspective, or on staff in Leinster House. Mm. So Stephen rightly says...
Or Regina, if you'd worked there for 15 years, I'm probably condemning myself now to... being told to wait at the gate from this moment on. But if you arrive at the gate of Leinster House and one of the ushers is there whom you knew from the old days, they'll always say, go on in, Fergus. You don't have to ask who you're looking for, etc. Now, as I say, that's probably the last time it'll ever happen to me. But it's not as difficult as all that to wander around Leinster House. It certainly, if you're an ordinary constituent... It's very difficult to get access. You have to know the TD and you have to be sure the TD is in their office and all that kind of thing. But if they know you, they let you in.
And that's the point, Stephen. I mean, you say that if you want to talk to Regina, you'll phone up, you'll make an appointment, you'll come in. But you presumably are at numerous events at which Regina will be at, whether it's dinner functions or other gatherings where you have a chat.
You may do, but I mean, again, I think you could greatly exaggerate the incidence of such happenings. Myself and Regina, I don't think, have bumped into each other for quite a while.
No, but you know what I mean.
No, I know. Of course, I take your point. And indeed, there are such events. But what I'm saying is that the system is a lot more professional than that now. My experience, and I mean this genuinely, I would not get away with, you know, wanting to grab somebody, you know, as they go, from meeting A to meeting B. It's unfair, actually, to try to ambush people in that casual manner. You know, invariably now, I mean, and there's no reason why. The tools of the trade are very amenable. You know, as I say, typically email. The easiest thing I can do, rather even than try to pick up the phone and ring Regina, the easiest way is to send her an email, tell her what I'm concerned about. I would be asking, you know, for time to meet her at her convenience, or if it was something more urgent. But again, she can make a decision on reading mine and say, no, I'm not going
to. Well, that's the point, isn't it, John? I mean, is the important bit here the person who's being lobbied? The lobbyist can do essentially whatever they want, can go as far as they want, but it depends on the person who's being lobbied's response.
I don't think the burden should be exclusively on the lobbied, on the public official or representative to meet acceptable standards. Lobbyists need to meet those similar standards too. And while Stephen and Fergus, myself, are very open about the way in which we lobby, not all lobbyists are as happy to share information on their engagement with public officials. And they rely on that access, on almost exclusive access, and the advantage that comes with that to make money. And I remember when I was studying public relations myself and I was thinking about going into this industry, I was advised by a lobbyist just to get myself a black notebook and a mobile phone. All I had to do was generate the contacts, the networks, and build my reputation on that. And many lobbyists, Frank Flannery was getting €60,000 retainers just to meet and make phone calls. He wasn't preparing papers. He wasn't undertaking reams of research here.
We don't know what he was being paid to do, and we won't know that until tomorrow.
I know, having interviewed enough lobbyists...
But you're making a very generalised, sweeping statement about a thoroughly decent man without, in the absence of the information.
I'm not casting any aspersions on his character.
No, you just said Frank was being paid €60,000 for making phone calls, and it's not fair.
He wasn't engaged in much more than
making contact. You don't know that, John. So will you
officials.
Please refrain from saying that until tomorrow?
There are many in the industry who rely on their access, on their contacts, to lobby and to seek an advantage for their clients. And I've interviewed enough lobbyists to know that many of them are charging, or were charging, huge retainers for doing very little other than making phone calls and having a quiet ear and a quiet word in a minister's ear. Now, not all lobbyists are engaged in this kind of practice, and I'm not saying there's anything unlawful or necessarily unethical about having a quiet word in a minister's ear. But it's an area that has gone on unregulated and which will continue to go unregulated if the current proposals put forward by government aren't enhanced.
Again, that's not true. How will it continue to go unregulated? The proposed bill that will be passed before the summer recess sets out a strategy-based lobbying activity register that will be regulated by SIPO. And all of the people that I mentioned earlier on will be, you know, compelled to register anything that any activity that they have been lobbied for, but also the lobbyist will be compelled to register their activity there under. So how, you know, suddenly this is groundbreaking legislation that has never happened before, and suddenly there's nothing happening, it's going to be the same old.
Well,
that's not true. And actually, in fact, I have to tell you, and I personally believe this, you're giving lobbyists a bad name by what you're saying tonight, because you give the impression that people are overpaying, you know, for representations that are obviously valuable, and the vast majority of people who've lobbied me in my 5 years of representative politics are decent people doing a decent job on behalf of organisations, the vast majority of which are not.
I never said that most lobbyists were engaged in anything.
You're giving a very bad impression of people who are doing a fine job.
Types of lobbyists. There's an access lobbyist, there's a content lobbyist. The content lobbyist rests on the knowledge that they bring with them to influence an outcome. An access lobbyist rests on the contacts that they have. And
I'd have to challenge that again, because the inference of what John is saying is that ministers are very puppet-like creatures, and that certain people paid lots of money are able to, one, get access to them, and two, bend their ears as in, you know, whisper something and the minister jumps to and get results. I mean, quite frankly, exactly. I mean, honest to God, John, that is a stereotype that is absolutely meaningless.
How are many public appointments made to the boards of state bodies?
That's a different matter now.
I'm fascinated by what Stephen says, because we know there's an unhealthy relationship. We know that there has been an unhealthy relationship between aspects of big business in Ireland and politics. We know that that unhealthy relationship has led to scandal in parts of the construction industry, in parts of the financial services sector, and so on. And we know that at the root of that unhealthy relationship has been access and content, access and, you know, whisperings in ears and so on. We know that. And were it not for the laws of libel, you know the names of the people involved, and I know the names of the people involved, and we could name them, but we're not going to do that because we don't want to plunge RTÉ into a deeper financial mess.
But I think you'd agree, we could talk about tribunals and we could talk, we're talking about an era that happened.
I hope that is true. I hope that is true. Yeah. I do know that when, you know, lobbying became synonymous with Conway's Pub and brown envelopes and
this
so on.
This was the 90s, I
that
agree
we
with you.
All said.
That's called corruption.
Yes,
yeah. You know, like
this was the 1990s.
There's a distinct difference because lobbying became synonymous
with corruption in the activities of Frank Dunlop. And it was the wake-up call. We all said it at the time. Time to regulate, time to act, time to put a statute in place. Years and years later, and we're still looking at the content of the statute. We still haven't actually got it right yet. And you can't... I mean, I really, really hope that there is nothing untoward going on behind the scenes in any of this. And I really hope that ministers are not being influenced by...
Do you believe
unhealthy.
The culture has sufficiently changed?
I think the culture is not as bad as it was. There's no doubt about that. But I think if we've learned nothing else in Ireland, and, you know, the sector I work in, 6 months ago, nobody would have said, we need a regulator and we need it now. That's my sector, in which I'm very, very proud to work and totally committed to working in it. It needs to be regulated. If we've learned nothing else in Ireland, it is that this kind of activity has to be firmly regulated, and you cannot assume that everyone is going to act honourably all the time.
Stephen, do you agree with that? I mean, is there still, not among your clients, I'm not suggesting that for a single second, but is there, have you ever heard that, you know, the offer of money, is that still an idea in people's mind when lobbying?
I'm not trying to sound naive or pious here, not that I'm aware of, genuinely. We know the record, particularly going back to the early 90s and Frank Dunlop's behaviour, for which he ended up in jail. Mm-hmm. We know the tales that emerged out of some of the tribunals. I think they and those very events, disreputable as they were, have had a very salutary effect on how public life is conducted now. And certainly it's my experience, and I mean it is that, you know, that whole process of lobbying is very open, is very above board now. And I mean, what Regina has outlined there, it conforms, and we, as I say, have supported it as an industry for many years. It conforms to the principle of, you know, who is lobbying whom about what.
Is it lucrative, Stephen? Is it a lucrative business to be in?
Is it lucrative? You know, again,
you have some pretty big name clients.
We have some, yes. But the point is, like, that people will make the association that, like, lobbying would be, if I'm speaking personally, lobbying would be maybe 25 or 30% of my day-to-day work. I mean, I would do, you know, a variety of other so-called, you know, public relations, communications activities. So the country is so small and there's quite a few people in this space. There are a few people out there. I can think of one or two who probably are making a very good living out of it, lobbying, nothing else. The most of us are doing that along with a lot of other things as well in the broad communication space. Therefore, is it rewarding from a financial point of view? It contributes, but it's not a standout way of getting rich quick or slow.
Well, can you represent Ergrid as well, don't you?
I have worked for them, yeah. I'm not working on any particular assignment right now,
project.
But I have, yes, I have worked for them.
I mean, can you give us an example of some successes you've had in lobbying, the types of changes that you've achieved through lobbying on behalf of your clients?
Well, it would depend. I mean, quite frankly, there would be a variety of circumstances. But in the main, it will be around legislation that may be being formulated. I mean, again, the system is very open and clear. At the beginning of each Dáil term, the government will publish a legislative programme which will run from bills that are going through the House now to ones for which even the heads are only being formulated. That's where, you know, somebody like myself will take a look. You may already have an interest on behalf of some client, but you know now, or the government may well announce it, or a minister may announce, we are now planning. And again, it's important to bear in mind, and Regina will know this through the various Oireachtas committees, or indeed ministers will actually invite submissions on planned legislation. So there is no mystery about an awful lot of the activity that somebody like myself engages in day and daily. It's about gathering political intelligence. It's about making sure that people for whom I am working are aware of developments. And it's about helping them to negotiate a path to the people who are going to make those decisions, and to, by dint of making their views and their interests known to the policymakers.
Okay.
That's what it's all about.
And John, are you convinced that the culture has sufficiently changed?
If it had changed, I'm not sure we'd need a new bill to regulate lobbyists.
Well, we haven't had one, John. That's the whole point.
We're introducing a new bill to regulate lobbyists, because there is a perception, at least a perception, that much of the legislation that governs us and public policy is being influenced behind closed doors, and
we've been looking for that register for
many years.
10 years plus.
Yeah. Well, if there wasn't a problem, then we wouldn't need the regulation. Haven't changed all that much.
Well, the trouble is that all these things in Ireland tend to be scandal driven, don't they? And charities are now going to be regulated because of scandal. Whistleblowers are now going to be protected because of scandal. Lobbyists are going to be regulated because of the fear of scandal or scandal. We never actually get proactive about changing culture. It's only when culture jumps up and bites us that we figure, gosh, we better move. And I think that's a terrible pity.
Yeah, I think the other point here as well is that much of lobbying will still go on without it being disclosed to the public, largely because it'll be an unenforceable regulation if the body that's charged with policing this area is not given resources that it needs to police it and investigate apparent breaches. The Standards and Public Office Commission doesn't have the resources as it stands to police the ethics and the electoral legislation. It has a handful of staff, has seven or eight staff to monitor political finance ethics disclosures by TDs and senators, and the electoral system. You compare that to Hong Kong, where they have an independent anti-corruption commission who 1,100 staff members.
Okay, as somebody who is regulated by CIPO, they do an absolutely superb job with
the
staff.
They do a fantastic job, but they have no resources to do that.
Fundamentally, when they are given new powers and a new remit, they will get the staff that will be required to actually monitor and regulate that.
I think we'll have to wait and see whether that actually happens.
You have a very negative opinion of number one, the bill that's been proposed,
and that will be drafted and passed by some. The laws aren't always enforced here. They might be on the statute books, but they may not always be enforced.
Well, I would disagree with you fundamentally.
Regina, can I just put, it's a story in the front page of tomorrow morning's Irish Times by Colm Keena, and it's following on the controversy surrounding Frank Flannery. And it's to do with, I'll just read you the first paragraph and see what you think. Mm-hmm. Philanthropy Ireland, the association that represents a number of Irish philanthropic organisations, and it was the organisation which paid Frank Flannery $60,000. It was given €631,635 by the Department of the Environment, Community and Local Government in 2012, the same year that Frank Flannery started to work for it on a consultancy basis. And most of the money went to the National Giving Campaign, which was an initiative, one of the key recommendations of the forum set up by the government, of which Frank Flannery was chairman. So just to read that again, Philanthropy Ireland was given €631,000 by the Department of the Environment.
For a good reason. Philanthropy is a good thing. But the suggestion here is that the only reason they got it is because Frank Flannery was appointed to the chair. How, there's no correlation there whatsoever. I mean, that's putting two and two together and coming up with five. Philanthropy is a good thing for government to support. It absolutely fundamentally is. And we also know from the register and from the freedom of information that's been released that the only lobbying that Frank did on behalf of Philanthropies Ireland was to the Minister for Finance.
OK, but the headline of it is, I suppose it sums it up really, perhaps, I'll see what you think. State Forum, led by Flannery, recommended funding for the group that later recruited him.
Well, somebody has written a very catchy byline.
I suppose it takes us right back to the beginning of our discussion, which is that I am mystified as to how Frank has found himself so conflicted on both sides of the same line.
Are you more concerned, or are you still saying that, you know, there's nothing there?
No, first of all, let me go back to the beginning of the conversation where I said, I've never said there was nothing there.
No, I mentioned
what I did say was that we don't know. And it's highlighted with two aspects, the news story that you've just read, but also the rehab story, which is what the Public Accounts Committee is there to root out, to make sure that the taxpayer is getting value for money in whatever the taxpayer spends its money on. But more importantly, the reviews that were started by the HSE into the Section 38s and 39s have highlighted a number of anomalies that are being followed up by the PAC. And I'm absolutely sure that that'll be followed up by the PAC also.
Fergus, what do you think of this year in particular? I know we're just seeing it for the first time here tonight.
Well, I mean, I said at the start that I was a bit dumbfounded by all that had been revealed, and I think that just adds to the
dumbfoundedness.
My sense of dumbfoundedness. I mean, 10% of the funding that was intended to be used for increasing awareness about the uses and benefits and need for more philanthropy in Ireland was given to one person who happened to be the chairman. It doesn't add up. It doesn't add up.
The principle here is the lobbyist and public officials should be able to justify the decisions to the public. We need to know what evidence was used or what reasons were used to make this decision to grant this organisation such a large amount of money. And the same principle should apply to all decisions that ministers and senior officials make.
Well, look, thank you all very much indeed. John Devitt, Regina Doherty, Stephen O'Byrnes and Fergus Finlay. We're back tomorrow night at 10. Till then, from all of us, good night.